Charles Colson has written that one of the very best pictures of the value system of contemporary America is Disney World, where people exhaust themselves in the pursuit of as many pleasures as they can possibly squeeze in to all the time that they can afford and only care for the moment. He said that he was recently at Disney World with his grandson, and one of the things that especially struck him was how desperate people were to have a good time, and yet how few of them seemed to be really enjoying themselves. He said he saw one mother feverishly mopping the brow of her sweaty little kid, checking off the things that they had seen, and yelling at her husband, "All right, how many more do we have to go?" I think, you know, he probably saved up all year for this trip, you know, and this is how they're enjoying it. And James is trying to call our attention to something very similar. He's saying, if in fact you set your heart to find joy on simply cramming in as many pleasures and possessions as you can into the brief span of this few years on earth, you will miss joy. Again, I remind you that James wants us to have joy. He is not trying to lay heavies on us in order to discourage us or to just simply make us feel guilty or to take away, you know, like the old bumper sticker or signs you see on the walls, "Everything I like is either immoral fattening or something else." I forget what. I didn't plan to say that, so I forget what the third one is. But you've seen them all around. You know, and it's just this kind of idea. You know, everything is really fun. Something's wrong with it. It's going to give me cancer or it's going to make me fat or do something else. And James is saying he wants us to see that, in fact, joy is not found by simply trying to cram as many pleasures as we can into this brief existence. He has warned us that those who set their hearts on this world and not on the kingdom, as we've just sung, show by that their hearts are not transformed by Jesus Christ. And therefore, when we come to stand before him, we will be judged justly by our sin, separated from God for eternity, and that the very riches that we have assimilated and gathered so feverishly to ourselves will then, for the rest of eternity, eat away at us in the fire of remorse. He has said this, you remember, in James chapter 1, beginning with verse 1. You remember his warning we looked at the last couple of weeks. "Now listen," James says, "you rich people. Weep and wail because of the misery that is coming upon you. Your wealth has rotted. Moths have eaten your clothes. Your gold and your silver are corroded. Their corrosion will testify against you and eat your flesh like fire." The problems of materialism. And then James, in the rest of this little section from chapter 5, verses 1 to 6, goes on now to describe what kind of person it is that is going to suffer this kind of misery and fate. And I believe that in this description, you and I can see four temptations of materialism, of riches, that assault us aggressively daily. And so I want for us to look at those and to learn what we can learn from them. Now, I wish that we had the kind of flexibility that I could preach this sermon in the mall. Yeah, I wish that we could have all been gathered in front of Hex or Woody's or Sears. Probably not in front of Sears. You'd be too close to all the eateries and everybody would be getting hungry. But, you know, somewhere out there in the mall where all this would be very real. You see, as you're sitting here now, it may not seem so real to you. But to be sitting there, right in the Temple of Columbia, where you'd be before all of the idols and all of the sacrificial altars, you know, for us to there be considering this might help us to feel the impact a little more. So if it helps you, imagine yourself now sitting in the mall, or, you know, the new car showroom, you know, or the visitor center with all the things that you'd like to get, and say, okay, now that's where I'm going to think about what James is saying to help me to apply it. What is it that James then is trying to say to us? Well, in verses 3, the third part of that verse, through verse 6, as I mentioned, James is giving to us four temptations. He's describing four characteristics of this person who's an outgoing, utter, thoroughgoing materialist. And you notice a couple things about these temptations. First of all, let me read them so that we have them in mind. The first temptation is in the end of verse 3, Temptation number one, you have hoarded wealth in the last days. Temptation number two, verse four. Look, the wages you failed to pay the workmen who mowed your fields are crying out against you. The cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord Almighty. Temptation 3, verse 5. You have lived on earth in luxury and self-indulgence. You have fattened yourselves in the day of slaughter. And temptation number 4, verse 6. You have condemned and murdered innocent men who were not opposing you. Now again, let me tell you that you and I can't look at this and say, I don't identify with that at all. The temptations, while we may not be doing the exact things that James is talking about, the temptations are the same for all of us. Now notice that temptation 1 and 3 have to do with ourselves. That has to do with our own attitudes. And temptations 2 and 4 have to do with how those attitudes are worked out in how we treat other people. Notice also that temptations 3 and 4 are more evil than temptations 1 and 2, by which James is seeking to illustrate to us the progressive corrosive nature of greed, sort of like the deteriorating face of Dorian Gray as it reflected the person who that picture was of as they progressed in their own deterioration into greed. So what we want to do is to look at this progression. Now, if there's one thing that I can do that will guarantee frustration in the offices each week, it's to put little arrows in my bulletin outlines. Because, you see, the computer can't type arrows. And so what happens is whoever types the outline always puts it in and says, I know I'll go back and I'll do those arrows, but somehow there's always enough phone calls and other things to distract me. Arrows never get in there. So there's space there between 3 and 4 on that second line. Should have a little arrow. See, 3 leading to 4 is more, and that word should be evil. I don't know how Will got in there, but forget him. It should be evil, more evil than one arrow leading to 2. Progressive corrosion of greed. And then under the main Roman numerals, you have Roman numeral 1, and then put little arrows next to 2, 3, and 4, because 1 leads to 2, which leads to 3, which leads to 4. That's what I want us to see. First of all, point 1 then. You accumulate only for yourself. Only for yourself. Verse 3c. You have hoarded wealth in the last days, James says. Notice where the problem begins. It is not a problem that begins necessarily in anything bad. It begins by good Christian stewardship. We need to save, we say. And so there's nothing wrong with saving, except that the saving can become an insatiable appetite for accumulating, not necessarily a lavish lifestyle. Next door neighbors, where I grew up, were people who lived extremely modestly. From 1960, when they moved in next door, to 1982, approximately the year that the head of that home died, they had only 2 cars. One was a 1947 Chevy, and the other one was a 1965 Plymouth, and it wasn't even the best model Plymouth. I don't even know if it had a radio in it. Certainly didn't have white walls or anything else. 2 cars. But he had a little hobby. His hobby was collecting gold. Yeah, and he'd collect all kinds of minted coins, you know, the proof sets, and solid gold, all kinds of things. And it's said that when he died, he had hundreds of thousands of dollars of gold stashed away upstairs. Now, you know, there is a guy that you could say, hey, boy, you know, no lavish living for him. But where was his security? James says, you have hoarded wealth in the last days. And he puts in there the last days to show you. You see, these days are very short. And you're hoarding up for all that you're going to think you're going to enjoy. And you're never going to enjoy it. Yeah, for those of you who may have been through the Depression, there may be a tremendous temptation to hoard because of remembering the lack and the tremendous want that there was back then. And James is saying this hoarding is showing where your heart is. Your security is in yourself. That's one of the reasons why it is so important that every Lord's Day, part of our worship is the taking up of our first fruits offering, the giving of our tithes, at least 10% of what we have made to the Lord. Just to remind us that our security is in Him, not in how much we can accumulate and how much we can save and how much we can gather to ourselves. I was really pleased to see that when one family in our congregation some time ago was suffering in enough want that they couldn't pay their rent, that a couple of others joined together to pay that out of their savings. It was a demonstration that we can give from what we have saved, not to hoard it, but to invest it, to give it for a brother and sister. That's how the body works. That's supernatural. I don't do that naturally. You don't do that naturally. That's the Spirit of Christ. James says, when you don't have Christ, you hoard. There's that temptation to gather to yourself. The Bible gives a couple of examples of this, a negative one and a positive one, a lot of places, but in Luke there's two that are especially helpful. And I just want to refer you to them. In Luke chapter 12, verses 15 to 21, you remember Jesus talks about the man building all the barns. And his point there, he says, is that life does not consist in the abundance of the possessions that you accumulate. The other side of that is in Luke chapter 16. That's the positive example. Do you remember in Luke chapter 16, Jesus told that strange story of the fired manager, the fellow whose boss had kicked him out, and so before the last day came, he decided that he was going to at least try to make something out of this, and so he went to all the bad debtors, do you remember? And he said, hey, we're going to have a sale on money today. And he goes to this one guy and he says, how much do you owe? And he says, 800 gallons of oil. That's olive oil, not crude oil. And he says, okay, today, for today only, have I got a deal for you. 400 gallons and you're off free. So, you know, hey, great. You know, he writes off 400 gallons, you know, and somebody else owes him 1,000 bushels a week. Great, today only, 800 bushels and you're clear, you know. So he goes, and Jesus commends that. Yeah, you look at that, you say, boy, what a scoundrel. But Jesus says, that's great, because this guy knew what he wanted, and he knew how to get it. And the point in Luke 16:9 is that Jesus says, I tell you, that he says after verse 8, people in this world know how to use what they have to get what they want. And his problem, Jesus says, problem you have is you're ambivalent about how to use what you have. Verse 13 says, the ambivalence between serving God and money. And Jesus says in verse 9, I tell you, use your worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Now, a lot of people say, what in the world does that verse mean? I think it's rather clear in the context that Jesus is saying, when you invest in missions, in the worldwide work of the church, in the global outreach of the gospel, your money in paying for others, you're not over in some other country, but they're over there preaching the gospel. The Iversons get these tapes, you know, every so often, and so eventually they'll hear this, you know. We give to the Iversons, they're over in Japan preaching Jesus Christ. Our money, used for that purpose, is gaining people into the kingdom so that when you and I go to heaven, Jesus says they're going to welcome us. They're going to know somehow, whether symbolically or really, I don't really know, but they're going to know somehow that you and I were part of bringing them into the kingdom. And Jesus is saying, you really want to know how to use your wealth, invest it for eternity. That's the opposite of hoarding it for yourself, you see. Investing it so that people are brought into the kingdom, and he says they'll welcome you when your money doesn't matter anymore. And that will matter for eternity. The second point here is the matter of selfish dishonesty to others. That first point, the temptation to hoard for myself, will lead to a selfish dishonesty to others. Verse 4, look, James says, the wages you failed to pay the workmen who mowed your fields are crying out against you. In fact, he says, the cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord Almighty. Now, what's he referring to? He's referring to there an Old Testament law, Deuteronomy chapter 24, in verses 14 and 15. The law says, do not take advantage of a hired man who is poor and needy, whether he is a brother Israelite or an alien living in one of your towns. Pay him his wages each day before sunset, because he is poor and he is counting on it. Otherwise, he may cry to the Lord against you, and you will be guilty of sin. That's what James is referring to. Incidentally, a demonstration that the Old Testament law is still in effect in its principles today. But what James is actually saying here is that you are trying to invest what you have, hold off from somebody to get a better deal, so that, you know, when he finally screams loud enough, then you'll pay attention to him. But your whole intent is to get the best deal you can get, as a good steward, of course. I remember back in 1967 when we first got married. We didn't have very much, and we lived in this place. I actually lived in a girl's dorm, but, you know, there was some privacy there, I'll assure you of that. But in this place, we had a little kitchen, and we wanted to put a floor in it. So I went down into Wilmington, Delaware, in a place where I heard you get some good deals, really bargain. This guy had a floor there. It was maybe retailing for $150. So I heard you could bargain, and I offered him $50 for it. Well, you know, he countered with something like $100, you know, so I came up to $60, and he's down to $90, back and forth. You know. And I didn't have the sense to know when to quit. And I'm still thinking, I'm going to get the best deal out of this guy, you know. And so I keep going, you know, and pressing and pressing. Finally, after my last offer, he called me a number of very uncomplimentary names and a very loud voice and told me to get out of his store, that he never wanted to see my ugly face again, and that I couldn't have his floor if I wanted it. Well, as I thought about that, I thought, you know, there's a very fine line between bargaining and simply the greed that says, I want to get this person as low as I can get him. I'm not going to be concerned about whether this is fair, about whether I'm trying to be honest with this person, but I'm just going to do the best that I can. John Calvin, in his sermon on the Eighth Commandment, had, I thought, a very insightful observation, so good that I put it into your bulletin there. He says, for as soon as that lust for gain takes hold of us, it is certain that we will become thieves. It cannot be otherwise. Calvin's saying, as soon as you and I do not resist greed, but we entertain that idea of hoarding and gathering to ourselves, inevitably we will not treat others honestly. We will cut corners, we will do all kinds of things, and that is so fed into the American mindset. Japanese people, for instance, consummate deals with a shake of a hand. They don't know how to deal with Americans, because Americans want a 15-page legal contract that they can write up, have the guy sign with 3 notarized witnesses, and then go hire a lawyer to find loopholes in the contract. You see, it's because of the greed that we will inevitably try to find ways to gather more to ourselves, and even as Christians perhaps justify it as a good deal and brag about it, while in fact it's simply greed seeking to take advantage of other people who are weaker. Not that they're weaker, but this attitude is certainly demonstrated as you and I fill out our income tax forms, isn't it? What is our attitude? To give what is legal and honest, or to try and take advantage of a system that we don't like simply so we can accumulate more? This leads to the third point. The third point is that of indulging yourself, indulging only yourself. You see, there's a progression here. James says it starts by, you know, going to be a good steward, want to save. Save leads to, and by the way, there's nothing wrong with saving and investing. What he's talking about here, of course, is the hoarding that goes beyond what is necessary as a provision for your family and for your future. So be sure about that. He's not talking against saving. He's talking about the hoarding, which is simply that greed, which goes beyond what is necessary. That leads to cutting corners, dishonesty, taking advantage of people that you think you can, that are weaker. That leads to then going beyond that to indulging yourself, James says. Verse 5. He says, you have lived on earth in luxury and self-indulgence. You have fattened yourselves in the day of slaughter. This is a further downward progression of this whole matter now. Now you're not just accumulating and saving, but you're rationalizing a richer and richer lifestyle at the expense of others. It's a self-indulgence. In order to understand this, let me try to apply this more specifically to 3 age levels right here in this room. First of all, think about what this means for you teenagers. You know, that's all you in the back, the upper, you know, the gallery and all the rest. What does it mean as a teenager to read this verse? Well, you know, there's a principle that I think operates pretty much from generation to generation in an affluent society. And we are in an affluent society. And the principle is that my parents' wants become my needs. What my parents got by retirement, I want to have by the time I'm 30. You know, you see that all around. This is what the standard that I am used to. Now, you know, my parents may be 30 years older than me, but that's what I want, and I want to get it within 10 years. And that kind of a goal determines what you are open to in the leading of Jesus Christ in your life. And so how you determine what is important to you will determine, for instance, as we go into our missions conference next month, And we talk about the opportunity of completing, reaching the unchurched or the unevangelized people groups, approximately 17,000 of them, through the rest of the world, the possibility of doing that in the next perhaps 12 to 15 years, and you say, that's a tremendous challenge, but it doesn't fit my goals. Because my goals are to fatten myself. My goals are to indulge myself. My goals are to get all that I can get that this world has to offer. And so I'm not open to consider the call of Jesus Christ to what James talks about in investing ourselves for people rather than for things. That's something that you need to think about. You need to be really honest as you look at your life goals and say, where do things fit in that and where does kingdom service fit in what I'm aiming to do, what I'm preparing to do, where I go to college and all the plans that I have for training as well as for career. But it's not just to the teenagers, of course. For those of us here who are in our 20s and 30s, I find there's a dynamic that functions too, and that is the need to always defer certain people-type goals in order for certain things that I need to get now. After we get this, then we can slow down our pace. After we get this, then we can give more time to starting or paying attention to our family. After we get these things, fattening ourselves, rationalizing, this is what I need to have. There's kind of an anatomy of a developing need, you know. It's interesting. You can apply this to many, many different things. But think of this progression. You see something and you say, boy, that's something I'd never get. I can't understand a Christian having that. I mean, that's just too rich for me. That's the first stage. Just rule it out. The second stage is, as you go on, you begin to notice it more and more, and you begin to notice there are a few Christians that have it. And so you say, well, you know, maybe it's really not all that wrong to have it. You know, and for some people, maybe that's okay. And, well, you know, on to the third stage, maybe someday I'll even be able to get it. I mean, if God provided a lot of money and I had it all, maybe someday I'd be able to get that too. I'll just think about that as something someday. Fourth stage, wonder how much it really costs to get that. I mean, you know, I notice more and more people have it, and, you know, maybe it isn't all that bad. And so the fifth stage, with some help from some salesmen and others, you know, you find out, you know, it really isn't that bad a deal. You know, I mean, it's an awful lot of fun you can get from this, and after all, God hasn't called us to be ascetics, and maybe it isn't all that bad a deal after all. Maybe it's something that I could use to reward myself in the years ahead if I think about saving for it. Leads to the next stage. All my friends have it. Now, all my friends, of course, is defined by all the people that I notice who have this because I'm very interested in it, and so it seems like everybody that I look at has it. And they all have it, and they're enjoying it. Why don't I have it? Which comes to the seventh stage, finally. I got to have it. And I'll go on time for it. I'll put it on my card. I'll pay for it somehow, but my mind has now become fixated on that as an object of pleasure, and without it, I will never be happy. Now, that's something that can consume you and me as we move through those years where we're acquiring and determining the level of our lifestyle. But, you know, it doesn't stop there. So finally, to those of us, I'll put myself in this category, all right, of the older, the middle, and the older ages of the congregation. What's our temptation in verse 5? He says, you have lived on earth in luxury and self-indulgence. You have fattened yourselves in the day of slaughter. What about those in middle life and older? I believe there's a particular temptation that's distinct to this age group too. The nature of this temptation is that you look back on your life and you say, you know, when we started out, all my friends along with me were struggling and sacrificing. But you know, I've sacrificed long enough. And I've come to the point now where I realize if I don't start getting some of these things, I'm going to be too old to enjoy them. And so if I'm going to have any kind of pleasure in this stuff, particularly when I look at all my friends going beyond me and they're enjoying all these vacations and all the things that they've acquired, I begin to review my sacrificial lifestyle commitments. And I begin to wonder, really, was I committed to that for the long haul, or was it just an idealistic idea for the short haul? And I begin to rationalize sacrificial living. And bit by bit, I begin to change my priorities. I begin to say, I have sacrificed long enough. Now I'm going to sit back and I'm going to enjoy some things. And in that, I begin to lose the notion of a servant-disciple lifestyle. I begin to lose my commitment to examining my priorities closely, but rather I begin to forget what James is warning about here in the sin of self-indulgence. This is not saying that God doesn't want us to enjoy things. Anybody who knows me knows that there's a lot of things I like to enjoy. This is not saying that God wants us to be ascetics. What James is talking about is that self-centered investing in this world so our hearts are wrapped around our possessions and our pleasures in this life alone. And when I begin to, as I get older, look at the rethinking, the rationalizing of that sacrificial lifestyle, I move into what I call midlife complacency, where I lose the cutting edge. I go on a spiritual plateau, and I sort of accept the level of my commitment to Jesus Christ as that's where I'm going to be. And I don't look at growing and stretching beyond that, because my heart now has become dulled. And that is a tremendous danger, I believe, as we get on into where we have acquired the basics and the things that we've been satisfied with, but now compare ourselves with others who are enjoying more and more. But James wants to call our attention to the fact that these days are so short. You notice he says in verse 5, you've done this when? In the day of slaughter. What is the day of slaughter? Well, it's another way of referring to what he says in verse 3, the last days. It's those last days before the return of Jesus Christ when God will judge the hearts of men. And those who have set their heart on this world and not on Jesus Christ, God says you could describe that judgment as a slaughter. Utter separation from the presence of a holy God. Separation from his presence forever in judgment. That kind of notion, you see, that mentality leads to the last thing in this person's life. Point 4, selfish cruelty to others. Selfish cruelty to others, verse 6. He says, you have condemned and murdered innocent men who are not opposing you. Now, what does that refer to? We remember back in chapter 3, verse 16, he had talked about the selfish ambition that can lead to disorder and every evil practice. Do you remember in chapter 4 and verse 2, James had talked about, he says, you want something, but you don't get it, so you kill. You covet, but you can't have it. You can't have what you want, and so you quarrel, you war, and you battle for it. And so the killing that he refers to there is not necessarily literal murder. It rather may have to do with the direct or indirect destroying of other lives through our greed. Now, that selfishness that isn't concerned for the good of others and may, in fact, lead to destruction. A classic Old Testament example of this was in the life of Ahab, recorded in 1 Kings 21. Ahab, you remember, was a religious leader of God's people. And you remember Ahab looked out every day from his backyard, and he saw his neighbor's backyard. This is this guy Naboth over there. And he looked at his yard and he said, boy, I sure wish that I had Naboth's yard. You know, I could do a lot over there, extending my garden, and, you know, the view would be better if only I had his yard. I mean, the guy's the king. He's got, you know, how many yards does he have? But I want Naboth's yard. And so he went to Naboth and he offered him. He said, I'll pay a best price. What do you want for it? Naboth says, it's against the law of God for me to sell my father's inheritance. I cannot do that. That was right. He couldn't do it. So Ahab goes back and he sulks and he pouts and he says, boy, you know, life isn't worth living. I can't have that yard on there, you know. And his wife, remember her name? Jezebel. And she wasn't called, you know, we get the word Jezebel from the kind of woman that Ahab's wife was. And Jezebel comes and says, hey, Ahab, what's the matter? He says, oh, I can't have Naboth's yard, you know, things are pretty grim. She says, hey, man, no sweat. I'll get it for you. So Jezebel calls together a kangaroo court, assembles some people around, and she says, okay, now, she pays off, bribes a couple of guys, and says, there's been a rumor here that Naboth's been cursing God and the king. Is that true? These two guys, they come up and say, yeah, I heard Naboth cursing God and the king, a couple others. And so after she's paid these people off, there's the condemnation. Naboth is executed by stoning. Jezebel comes to Ahab, and she says, hey, Ahab, guess what? That yard's free over there now. You can take it. And he confiscates it. Now, you see, it was all done without Ahab necessarily involving himself in anything wrong. All he did was let certain things unfold so that he could get what he wanted without any concern for his neighbor. You think of how cruel we can be for such little things we'll gain. Do you remember the story of David Heartless back in the Flyer and a number of other papers last fall. Fellow lives right here in Columbia. Kid went to school here just like any other kid in Columbia. Killed Angelica, the girl, a friend of his that worked in the Heinz drugstore, for $100. Murdered her for $100. That's one way that we can see this work out. But there are other ways. I think of a person who went to an evangelical church in this area while scheming to take over a business and by fraud and deception ruin a business for his own gain while going every Sunday to church, totally isolating his business ethics from his profession of Jesus Christ as Savior of his life. Where you and I, we look at our investments. Do you know what your investments are used for? One time, a few years ago, God convicted me of this to find out money that I put into my pension or my investments is being used for something. What's it being used for? Anything good? Neutral? No, not neutral. Anything good or anything bad? Whatever your position about South African problem and how to solve that, it may be of interest to you to know. Are my investments being used in South African mines? Or are they being used in certain things here in the United States that I couldn't condone? I had to find out about my investments and satisfy myself that not only was I making money, but I was making it in a way that was not being cruel to other people, condemning and destroying innocent people. And you and I have a responsibility in our money for that. Or to take another example, you know, it's been surveyed and demonstrated that in a number of suburbs of the United States where teenage suicide rates are the highest, there are two things in common in almost every case. They are affluent suburbs in which the parents have put pressure on the kids to be overachievers and they have spent very little time with them developing their character. Now, you could say, hey, the parent would say, I don't identify with that verse at all. But James says, you have condemned and you have murdered the kids in your own family by neglect and the pressure that you have placed on by imposing your lifestyle. Now, we have to examine in our own case, what are any ways that you and I have mistreated thoughtlessly other people because of the greed that you and I have for gaining for ourselves? But in conclusion, let me remind you that that last phrase there, you have condemned and murdered innocent men, literally in the Greek is the innocent man. It's singular, and it's another way you could translate that is the righteous man. When I thought about that, I realized that Jesus said at one time, inasmuch as you've done this to the least of these, you've done it to me. And how you've treated other people, Jesus says, is the way you've treated me. Or you take, for instance, Proverbs chapter 14, verse 31. A proverb says, he who oppresses the poor shows contempt for their maker, but whoever is kind to the needy honors God. Do you remember why Jesus was betrayed? It was by Judas for money. It was for 30 pieces of silver that the innocent man was condemned and murdered by Judas. And I think we have in Judas here the classic picture of what James is speaking of as the ultimate conclusion of a heart of greed. God used that to accomplish his own purpose. That purpose was that through Judas' betrayal for money, Jesus died for greedy people like you and me. Jesus died that your greed and my greed, that your thoughtlessness and my thoughtlessness as a result of that would be forgiven and could be removed. That we would be delivered from the bondage of that greed, from the penalty that we deserve for that greed. And that Jesus has delivered even a man like Zacchaeus, that greedy tax collector. Do you remember he took Zacchaeus and he went into his home and here was a fellow that was as greedy as any of us. And Jesus said, today, salvation's come to this house. And Zacchaeus says, my life has changed. And Zacchaeus says, I'll give back to anybody that I've cheated. Because grace converts grabbers to givers. The mind of Christ, when you and I understand what it cost him to suffer and to die so that your greed and my greed would be fully forgiven, produces in us a spirit of giving and generosity because of our love for Him. Let me conclude by an example that I think illustrates this so well. A number of us are familiar with the ministry of Labrie Fellowship and how God raised that up and how many, many people, hundreds and thousands throughout the world, have come to know Jesus Christ through the ministry of Francis and Edith Schaefer as they operated that retreat over in Switzerland for so many years. We're aware, many of us, of how God miraculously provided for that fellowship. When they were being kicked out of Switzerland, they needed within 24 hours $1,000 for a down payment to buy a chalet. And how the next day there were three pieces of mail, and the first two were inconsequential, but the third one, there was a check in it. No one knew about this need for $1,000 exactly on the day that they needed it. And that was the beginning of the Labrie work. But many people don't know the other side of that story. What about those who sent the $1,000? Why did they do it? This was the letter that came with a check. Art came home from work 3 months ago with a check that was a surprise. The company paid all the insurance premiums for men who had worked for a certain length of time and made it retroactive. We went to look at houses to invest in, and as we looked at the beams in a likely small house, I said, Art, look at those termites. Doesn't that remind you of the verse in Matthew which says, not to lay up treasures on earth where moth and rust corrupt? Art said, yes, it did. And I said, would you be willing to take that literally and for us to invest this money in heaven by giving it to the Lord's work somewhere? And he replied, yes, Helen, I would. She went on to tell of their praying for clear certainty as to where to use this money during 3 months. Now tonight, we are convinced that we should send the enclosed to you to buy a house that will always be open to young people. The check was exactly $1,000. That was the beginning of the Labrie work. Jesus says, use your money to gain friends for yourselves, that when it's gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Amen.